All right. Yuko, am I saying your name correctly?
Yes.
Good. It looks kind of hard to mess up, but I'm betting people still do it.
Yeah, there's been like Yuki's and Yoko, because, you know,
of
Yoko
course.
Ono.
I do know of Yoko Ono. As a white artist married to an Asian woman, yes. I am very familiar with who Yoko Ono is.
Yep, I've had that quite a few times, but no, it's Yuko, yeah.
It is Yuko, which is a cool name. Where are you from, Yuko?
I'm from Tokyo, Japan.
Tokyo, Japan. Love it. Haven't been there yet. Big fan of its overall vibe, though. Wonderful.
Yes.
Are you born and raised Tokyo in the city?
I was not born in Tokyo. I was born in like the southern part of Japan, southern east side in a very small island.
Okay.
And then right after I was born, my family moved to Tokyo because of my parents' jobs. And I was actually only there until 4, and then we moved abroad.
Okay. All right, well, let's slow down here because we're already off to the races. I feel like I got all these questions. Let's start with this. Parents, work. What are mom and dad doing for work that takes them from a small island into Tokyo?
My dad has a very interesting job. He works for a company that manufactures, those like thin rubbers on those that are on windows. He works for a factory.
Yeah, like a gasket, like the sealant thing.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, so he works for a factory where he makes that. He have a white collar job. He works in the office.
Yes, yes.
Is he like a manager?
Yeah, basically.
Did he get a promotion to oversee a big gasket factory?
I don't know how he moved to Tokyo.
You were
I
four.
Guess the company that he worked for had a factory abroad. So that's where he got transferred.
So where did you go from Tokyo then? What does abroad mean?
We lived in Malaysia.
Okay.
In Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
We were there for, it was supposed to be 3 years, like every other expat family, but it somehow grew to 5. And then it grew to 11.
Holy shit. So now you're like 15 and you still live in Malaysia?
Yeah, I only got back. We only, got back to Japan when I turned to 10th grade was when we moved back.
That's so interesting. That's such a formative period of time. I seriously doubt you remember very much of the first Tokyo experience.
No, yeah, I don't remember much at all.
Yeah, that whole vibe. Yeah, so that's different. And then you really kind of grew up in Malaysia. Do you feel that way?
Yes. Yeah. My parents like really took that opportunity to help, me and my sister be really involved within the community and sort of be a part of that local
older
life.
Sister, younger sister?
Younger sister.
Younger sister. What is your younger sister's name?
Yoshiko.
Yoshiko.
Yes, Y-O-S-H-I-K.
Did I say it right?
Mm-hmm.
I get really excited about stuff like that. I love names. Okay, so Yuko and Yoshiko, right?
Yes.
Okay, are growing up in Malaysia. After, and so your sister, was she born there or was she born in Tokyo and then you guys went?
Yeah, she was like 11 months old when we moved.
Okay, so baby, she's got nothing going on in Japan. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you say you're from Tokyo, which is definitely kind of true, but you're really from that small island, lived in Tokyo for a minute. You're kind of half from Malaysia because of all this huge 11 years of your childhood that you lived there. Mm-hmm. And then you moved back to Tokyo before you came to School of the Arts. Do I have that time right?
Yes. Yes.
Got it. My last
3 years of high school. Yeah.
So when you and your sister are growing up in Malaysia, what are you guys doing for fun? And more specifically, I guess, to follow up on what you said, what are your parents doing with you in the community? Are you at church? Are you at activities? Like what are you involved in?
So my parents decided to send this to a local school in Malaysia. They had a Japanese school in the city that we lived in because there were a lot of Japanese expat families like us.
Okay.
But instead, we went to a local kindergarten with, you know, Malaysian. So Malaysia, yeah. I'm not sure if you're familiar, but it's a multiracial country. So there's yes. Indian, Chinese, and Malay. So all of my classmates were pretty much that. And so I learned English when I was four. English, Malay, and Mandarin when I was four, when we got to the local kindergarten. And then after that, we went to a local elementary school and studied with the local kids there, which was definitely an experience for sure. But at that time, it's funny because I was pretty much more fluent in Mandarin than I was in English.
I was about to ask, like, where do you sit right now with language? Like, what languages do you feel right now today that you're very comfortable in?
Right now I'm most comfortable in English, and then
wow, okay,
yeah, and
you
then
sound Japanese incredibly comfortable next. In English. If I met you, I would not necessarily assume you were not born in the States. You have kind of a general English to you, yeah. But I wouldn't be able to pin it down. And I, you know, I was in the drama school. I studied accents for a mm-hmm. few minutes, so I definitely have an ear for it. But it's very curious. So you're kind of a mix of culture. At that age, you're really getting so many different things that a lot of people in that part of the world are not exposed to as diverse of a culture, I don't think. Yeah. Am I wrong? I mean, in Malaysia, yes, but like,
yes,
you
yes,
go to Japan, right. People are largely Japanese. You're everything's correct. In Japanese.
Right.
Korea's the same way. China's mm-hmm. the same way. But mm-hmm. you're getting this kind of almost a melting pot, right?
Right, right, exactly. And because Southeast Asia is like so many countries are so close to each other, my parents right. also took that opportunity to like travel to these different countries. And again, you know, because Malaysia is a multiracial country, like we have long breaks every month. So we took advantage
long
of
long breaks
that.
Every month?
What like long mean? Holidays, like oh, public
because
holidays.
There's so many different
right.
cultures like you have to take off for Ramadan and take off for.
Yes.
Wow, yeah. That's wild. We don't really do that in the States. We're very no. Western with our holidays.
Right.
That's interesting.
Exactly.
Malaysia's better at holidays than us, is what I'm hearing. That's the lesson I'm taking away from this so far. Okay, cool. And so. Is mom just taking care of the kids, or she work during all this? But
when we were living abroad, she was a stay-at-home mom. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Oh, does she work now, or does she retire?
She does work now.
What does she do now? What does she get into?
She works for a sort of like a concierge for a credit card company.
Oh, cool.
So she kind of answers phones and helps people. You know,
little customer service action.
Yeah, exactly.
We need that. I love it. So let's then get on board with Yuko's track with lighting design. Is that what your degree is in from the School mm-hmm. of the Arts, lighting design?
Yes.
Listeners of this show will know that, I have some familiarity with that particular area. I started off in DMP as a lighting, technician, not design, because I'm a dummy and I wasn't in the design program. Used to be able to just get an arts diploma back then with no bachelor's degree. You just like would go all arts classes and not take academics. So, but if you were in DMP and you didn't get the degree, then you had to be on the tech tracks. So you couldn't be a costumes designer, but you could be stitching. You couldn't be a lighting designer, but you could be hanging and programming. I was on that master electrician track, basically.
Uh-huh.
I like plugging things in and climbing on ladders. I don't know what it is. Let's talk about how you got there. How did you get into lighting as a thing? And then I don't think I've ever met an international lighting student that wasn't from like, I think there was somebody from the Caribbean once uh-huh. that I didn't meet him, but I like almost crossed over with him. I don't think we had anybody, maybe someone from Canada or Mexico. How do you come from so far away for lighting design? And then how you got into that in the first place?
I started being involved in lighting in high school when we moved back to Japan. They had okay. like a backstage, my high school had a backstage theater you know, like,
tech theater program
that I joined.
Yeah.
And they needed help with the lighting crew. I was, you know, at first I was only doing props, but they needed some extra hands for in the lighting crew. So I joined, and I don't know, something about the camaraderie of the crew that I was in, and like being hands-on with the things that you don't typically get to see from an audience point of view,
right?
Really attracted me. And I
were you like, already doing theater stuff in Malaysia?
No, I was doing a little bit. So backtrack.
Sometimes we go back and forth. Don't stress.
I was in Malaysia for 8 years, so until sixth grade. And then middle school, we moved to Singapore for basically to have a better like education, you know, school system.
Okay, the schools were better.
Right. We went to an international school in Singapore, my sister and I. Okay. So we moved there. And that's when I started being involved in like backstage crew at that school.
Got it.
And then I sort of tried to like find my way to continue that when we moved back to Japan and at my new school. So that's how I got involved. And then, yeah, I mean,
what made you stick with lighting rather than like, it sounds like you started in props, which I started in props. That's like the easiest shit in the world. No offense to props people, the people who make props. I'll give you more props.
Oh, yeah.
But the people who are just working props is like the easiest thing to do. It's a great starter position. Yep. So you're working there. You end up gravitating towards lighting. Are you interested more in the technical? Or are you interested more in the design of it? I would imagine at that age, you're doing a lot more technical and probably not designing very much. But did you have an interest in like, are you starting to pay attention to like beams and colors and shapes? Or was it very much a... I'm trying to hang stuff up. It's a good job. This is fun. Plugging shit in.
I think it was more of the process from as a whole. You know, I wasn't paying very much attention to the design part.
Right.
But
me either.
More
in the beginning.
Of like more. Yeah. More of like being like going from, you know, hanging fixtures to them, focusing and then programming and then seeing what you know, push buttons on
and then it happens.
Them seeing that on stage, and you know, it's
what kind
that
of
whole,
a technology?
Like, big
did
picture.
You have like a bunch of fancy lights, or was it a bunch of like PARs? Just like you're playing.
No,
with?
It was mostly, you know, like Source 4s and PARs. And
yeah,
we just started having like a couple moving lights when I was in my senior year, so it wasn't very advanced.
Your basic black box elements.
Yes,
you're getting to play around with. Yeah. I love that. I don't get to talk to lighting people very often. This is fun. So maybe you can help me articulate this because I don't talk to a lot of people who are into this, and I've always been. You know what? This is, I'm going to get even nerdier with you because I like what you said about watching it come to fruition and going from like, oh, we're just like hanging a bunch of stuff on a pole and now I hit go and it's like, that's cool. I'm with you on that. You know, what's extra satisfying for me. I love the hanging and focusing. My shit.
Fun.
I love climbing up there. I like getting the instrument. I like getting the focus. I like hiding the cables, tucking the cable around the catwalk in a way where it's like the gaff
with
and
the
you try
line.
To get it. Yes, dude.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what it is. It's so satisfying for me. It's almost like, you watch videos of people like power washing a driveway and that'd be like satisfying, right? With the hashtag or whatever. To me, and I started it when I was like 12 and I did it almost all the way through high school.
Okay.
I was always just addicted to the like putting everything where it goes, making it look nice, plugging it in and it working.
Yes.
Like it all works.
For sure. Yeah.
And I find that so satisfying, almost to my own detriment, because, and you probably experience this as well. You go out in the world and people find out you know how to plug shit in. Oh, God. Oh, no. Everyone knows now that you know how to make it work. Yuko, it's not working. Can you? Is that how many times have you heard that in your life, right? Like, it's broken. Where's Yuko at? Make her stop what she's doing and come over here and fix this. Do you like being that person? I've kind of resented it.
No, I mean, it, I don't mind it. It's, yeah.
It feels good to be useful.
Yeah.
I remember I got pulled out of a drama class because everyone in drama knew that I was the kid from DMP. There'd never been a drama kid from DMP before. And so once that's you, everyone's like, oh yeah, it's that kid. The dance teacher would pull me out of other classes and be like, I don't know what's wrong with the stereo. And I would be like,
oh my gosh.
And then of course, unfortunately, I would go in there and fix it. And it would be like, now I'm fucked because they're always going to come get me.
Yeah,
it's an interesting thing, right? Like having an attraction to that, because for so many people, it's something that they just want to take for granted. They just want it to work, right? Like they just want it to just work without having to think about it.
Yes.
But it really is people like you, and I would say people like me, but I do less kind of stuff like that these days. But it's us that bother to figure out how it all works and how to plug it in, that, man, they'd all be helpless running around like this. go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just going to say, it's also like a default workout for me. It's like a default workout.
Yeah.
For me with all these, like, you know, being hands-on with big fixtures.
Of course. Are you, it's hard to tell in this video. Are you like a small person? Or are you a taller person?
I am pretty small. Yeah.
How tall are you?
Well, not too small, but you know, like a normal,
normal for a young Japanese lady. Yes. How old are you?
Yes. I'm 24.
Yeah, you're 24 and you graduated in 21. Mm-hmm. So when you get to school, is there more of an interest in all the stuff we've just kind of been talking about, more of the mechanical, or did you start to take an interest in design at school, or did you get your degree in design?
I did. It was design. And
talk to me about how you get there, because it sounds like you were more of a button presser before you got there.
I was a button presser before that, but I think ultimately I was more interested in design, and I wanted to learn more about design because I didn't know very much going into school.
Was it about the money at all? It's way better money being a designer.
No, not really.
Less work, more money. It's true. Design is less work, more money. And they told us that when we were at school. Maybe not everybody, but I heard it from enough people. They were like,
interesting.
Well, if you think about it, right, that's true. Because as a technician, first of all, every fucking project needs how many designers? One. And an assistant. How many technicians does it need? More than one. Always. Mm-hmm. So there you go. There's your job amount. But also, as you go from design to design job, you have to convince people that you're the best person to be picked over all those other people and get that one job.
Yes.
They're like, I need five technicians. Do you know how a board works? They're like, yeah. You're like, you hired. Short interview. You know, can you do the thing? And so, but when you finally get that design job, it might have one more zero on the end of that paycheck than the mechanical job. Mm-hmm. Was that an element for you when you were making that decision as far as like your future?
No, I wasn't thinking that far. I just wanted to.
That's probably smart. That's probably smart, my friend. I wouldn't have overthought it. Probably, I definitely was a little bummed because I'm also colorblind. So for me, it's like probably shouldn't be a lighting designer professionally, or I'm just going to start disappointing people and getting in fights that I can't win. So for you, when you started getting interested in the design, you started to see it from afar and be like, oh, that's very interesting. I haven't really gotten a chance to mess with that yet. When you got there, what kept you there? What kept you from kind of going back to like, I just want to program the board and hit go? It's easier.
That's an interesting question.
Thank you.
I feel like our school, it's unique in the way that they first let you, you know, experiment both sides.
Yeah,
right?
That's where my question kind of
like,
comes
from.
Yeah.
Day one. I don't know. I knew that I would be better to be hands off with these fixtures, almost as to say, and then to sort of work on the creative side of things and then work with my electricians on how to make things work, if that makes sense.
No, it totally makes sense. What I'm hearing you say is you think it's a better play to your skill set to do the design than to do the electricians. Right. Despite your ability and awareness and knowledge and experience in the technical, you think it's a better use of who you are and what you can do to be working on the design. But let me ask you why. What is it about the design elements of skills that you bring? And I'm kind of asking you to brag about yourself here. So I'm sorry if that makes you uncomfortable, but what is it that makes you go, you're talking to a boss at some place and they're like, Yuko, I haven't really seen a lot of your design, but should we move you to the mechanical? Should we move you to the master electrician side? Make your argument to me for why you're like, no. I should be one of your designers for this reason. Not a mechanic. I can do the mechanical. And if you need that, I can do it. If that's the only job you have. But you should hire me as a designer because why?
It might sort of sound counterintuitive, but I think it's because design is, for me,
yeah,
it's a lot more challenging to convince people and to sort of like figure things out with like what I want, essentially. I don't know. I like the challenge that design brings, and I like to see the picture basically on stage or wherever, and to sort of compare that with where I started from. I think I don't, sorry, is this like not being articulate?
No, that's
at all?
Okay. I'm asking you a complex question for that reason.
Yeah, no, I think I enjoy more of like exploring the artistic side. I'm really big into like the finding the why into things.
Yes.
So like the whole storytelling thing, and you know, trying to figure out why I put this fixture over here as opposed to the other side. Why am I using this color? Why am I using this angle to light this? That to me sounds a lot more interesting than working technically on a board or, you know, like circuiting and stuff like that.
Can I give you some words and you tell me if they work for what you feel?
Sure.
I think I should hire you as a designer because you're a deeply curious person. I think very interested in getting to the bottom of the point of what we're doing here. And if that's the case, I would rather have that person as a designer than as a technician, because I don't want my technicians to be overly curious. I don't want them to be overly innovative. If they think it's a better idea for the cable to go this way instead of that way, and they have a reason for that and they want to change it, great. Mm-hmm. But I'm not looking to my electricians to innovate quite as much as I would want for my designers. I want the designers to think outside the box. I want the electricians to make the box work. The way that we know it does. Plug the thing in. Okay. Don't come up with some creative way to plug it in. Just fucking plug it in. Okay. Like, don't get too creative. I want consistency from that. Design. I want inspiration. I want a new idea. I want a curious mind that's like, what if we did this? That's a designer's mind in my head.
Thank you. Oh my goodness. Exactly. Yes.
You can use it in your next job interview, and I don't even need a cut if you get the gig. Keep it. Absolutely. Well, and I think that that's fascinating personally, because I think the same way. As I mentioned, I was on that track, that mechanical track. I love plugging things in. I love seeing it work. I love set everything up and then walk over here, flip the switch, and it all works. Like, that's so cool. I love that. But at the same way, I'm the one who spends an hour trying to find a new way to do a thing I could have had done in 5 minutes if I would have just done it the way that we all know it works. And then someone comes over and they're like, why isn't all this done? And I'm like, I'm really close to figuring out a better way to do it. And they're like, we don't care about that. We care that it isn't finished. That's all that matters. And I'm like, yeah, I probably shouldn't be doing this. I think you should get a different guy who never questioned it in the first place and already and is already on to the next task.
Right.
So when you are at school and you're connecting with the design stuff, are you studying with Norman at school?
Mm-hmm. Yes, but Norman also retired while I was at school.
While you were there. So. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then
so I had 2 years of Norman and then 2 years of Clifton.
That is a great, probably, combination to have it split up. I have the same thing. Our dean changed my senior year. And so the head of my directing program. So I got some of both, which was really kind of better. It's a little bit spoiled, honestly. Mm-hmm. What's the difference? Tell me, because I don't know Clifton. I only know Norman because he was there forever. What's the big difference? They're going to listen to this. Not really.
Clifton brought in a lot of new ideas and approaches to not only how to become a lighting designer, but also how to become a real human.
Oh,
in the lighting.
We have a life leader. Do we have a guru like on our hands?
How to become a good person in the industry, but I don't know, as like a whole, you know, like a professional.
What does that mean to you? Like, what did you learn from Clifton that you're like, man, I'm glad he came in because that's very helpful information, makes me a better human in the lighting community?
I think the biggest thing that I learned is to always like not take things for granted and to always, you know, like you said, be curious and also be very appreciative of
gratitude,
every opportunity that you receive, and you know, to not take everything for granted and to sort of dig deep into like why you do what you do, kind of thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Do you mean why you do what you do artistically in a play, or do you mean why you do what you do in a bigger sense of the word of like, why are you a lighting designer? Why are you an artist? Why are you doing this work?
I think it's a little bit of both. How can you apply that like bigger why into your smaller artistic why?
Right.
And to always, you know, take advantage and learn, continue learning, because lighting, there's always new things to learn about light and design and art and you know, so.
You know what I love about lighting in the sense that you just said, and sound is kind of this way too. You know how we know we're never done learning about it? Because both of those things, light and sound, exist on measurable spectrums of which there are large parts that we are unable to perceive. Like there's light that happens that we can't see.
Yes.
There's sound that happens that we cannot hear.
Yep.
Which means there's limit sure to what we can perceive, but obviously every human being is different, right? Some people are deaf. Some people can hear like high pitched stuff from way the fuck over there. Like, how are they able to hear that? Same thing with light. I'm fucking colorblind. This happened today, my new friend. Let me tell you something that happened to me today. I went shopping for a suit with my wife. This was so embarrassing. I went shopping for a suit with my wife. We're going to my brother-in-law's wedding. Her brother's getting married. We're going to go get a nice suit, right? Yeah, wait, sure. I'll tell him you said so. He's going to get married. I need a new suit. We go to the mall. We're looking at it. I find a jacket with some suits. It's a blue suit. There's jackets right here. There's pants on both sides, like on racks. I grab a pair of pants. I grab a suit. We keep changing sizes. At the last second, I was like, I think I want a slightly different size pair of pants. And I swap it out with another pair that I thought was on the same rack. I go and I put it on in the dressing room. I got the jacket on. I got the pants on. I come out in this suit and I go, well, and my wife goes, what? And I was like, what do you mean what? I'm asking you how it looks. Like, what are we doing here? And she goes, well, the color or the fit? And I was like, I'm so confused. What? Where we've been building this suit together for like 10 right. minutes, picking right. this out. What? How does it look? And mm-hmm. and she goes, well, honey, you picked a different color pair of pants. And I was like, what? And I look down and I swear to God, Yuko, blue. I'm like, it's fucking blue. What are you talking about? And she goes, hold on. What's the new size you wanted? And she goes back and she comes and she gets, hands me another pair of blue pants that are mm-hmm. indistinguishable to me. I'm looking mm-hmm. at the ones I have on and the ones she gave me. I'm like, I go in there, I switch them out. I'm like, these are way more comfortable. They mm-hmm. look like the suit. Mm-hmm. Apparently, these two pairs of pants were two different colors of blue that I'm incapable of seeing the difference between. Like, I just could not tell the difference yeah. between these two things. And my wife yeah. was instantly thrown off by my question because she was like, I don't know what your question is because yeah, now you're wearing a mismatched suit. What the fuck are we doing? Right. Like, we're both looking at each other like, are you crazy? And we finally walk away. And of course, I have to have the humility to know this is my thing. It's not her fault. I can't uh-huh. mad at her because she can see and I can't. And so just that alone shows that we as people are not done figuring color out. We mm-hmm. as people are not done figuring out light. We're not done figuring out sound. These things where some of us can't even participate. Right. That clearly means that we're in a level of figuring out how it works, the degrees, how we experience it, adjustments, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's lights, you know, being affected by the glasses. I haven't worn them, right. but you can wear the glasses that are like, make you not colorblind, apparently. Mm-hmm. I think that, man, that, and why wouldn't you be interested endlessly in something that we just can't solve, no matter how many thousands of years we try to study it? We're still never going to figure right. it all the way out.
And I think that's one of the beauties about like lighting design is that, you know, it's so like people can perceive that differently in many yes. different ways.
Yeah.
Even though you're looking at the same color, like my red might be a different to your red, you know.
It literally would be, I promise you, because based on my experience, nobody's red looks like mine. I can't see any of it. I don't know. I love that. Okay, so you get out of school, you've got these human life lessons and all this design knowledge that now you're hungry to do. What is the idea as far as like you get the year right in the States if you want it?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I did get that year. It's interesting because I sort of took a different route than I thought I would post grad.
Sure. That happens, believe me, more often than happens. You might guess.
That's okay, you know.
What does that mean?
So I graduated in 2021, which mm-hmm. COVID, while I was still in school, you know, it was still very much a thing.
Yeah.
And I realized that pursuing a freelance job as a non-US citizen during COVID was probably not the safest choice if I wanted to stay in the States.
Sure.
So during my senior year, second semester, the lighting program basically was introduced to architectural lighting design. And that was, you know, completely brand new to me. I didn't even care that there was architectural lighting design. The only lighting design I knew was theater. But basically, fast forward, I interned for an architectural lighting company post-grad. And then I had my one extra year with them, with my student visa. And then after that, I applied for the H-1B is what we call it. It's the lottery-based mm-hmm. employment visa.
Yep.
And I miraculously got selected the first
Holy
round.
Holy shit.
Yeah, that was crazy. That was like the most stressful year of my life. And I don't want
When was
go
that? You got that like right after? Did you get to just stay in the States?
That was last year in March, sometime around like March or February was when I got the news that I got selected.
I know it's a long time ago, but congratulations. That's a awesome thing to do.
Yeah. If that was not the case, I would have had to, I think Sophia mentioned this during her interview, but you know, get the O-1 visa, which is like,
right,
you need to like advertise your
prove like, that you're of value to the entire world.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I did that. So now I have until 2028 for now.
That with is this plenty of time.
Visa, as long as my company like sponsors this.
Right.
But anyways,
you still work for that
so
same architectural firm?
I do, yes. So like I have a lighting design and theater degree, but now I do work for architectural lighting.
That design. Is so awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, it really is. I'm so like, Yuko, let me explain something about this podcast. I know you just started listening, but one of the things that we're obsessed with, and I say we being mostly Steven and I and other people who helped me make this, it's like one of the things that I feel like is missing from the conversation while I was at school, and it sounds like a lot of this has changed, and I think COVID probably helped the conversation move along. I think a change in guard of people who are running the school helps a little bit too, just because there was a period really in the 90s and early 2000s where it was a lot of the same people ran it for like 20 years and they were just repeating what they've been doing, lot of which was very helpful, great, successful. But I've heard of a lot of recent kind of fun innovation stuff that I find, here's my argument. The conservatory skill set, the conservatory education, is a backwards up to now mindset in a helpful way, meaning we are going to teach you all the knowledge of the past, right? We're going to go through and we're going to teach you how lights used to be candles with fucking mirrors in them and all that. Like, we're going to teach you how the skill set grew over the history of humans trying to do it, focusing along the way on the people who were the best at it, the biggest innovations that made it what we do today. And we're going to give you lots of opportunities to practice that shit. Great, great education. The problem with that is, in my opinion, if you're not careful, you become overly focused with the past and you don't focus quite enough on the future. They're worried that if they focus too much on the future, it's going to diminish the value of the skill set they've built the based past. On the past,
yeah.
Right? This is a fallacy. This is a mistake. It is a huge mistake to assume that you can't walk and chew gum at the same time in this analogy, that you can't study this and keep this in mind and then use it to do the future. There's no reason why it doesn't play perfectly. In fact, everybody who's trying to do something good and great in the future should be very well versed on whatever it is they're trying to do and how it happened in the past.
Right.
Because that's how we learn from it. And so it, to me, I think there are people out there who might hear your story and go, oh man, it's a drag you're not a Broadway lighting designer. It's a drag you're not Cirque du Soleil in Vegas, you know, doing the Michael Jackson lighting, whatever the fuck. I don't like it, your story does not hit me at all that way. In fact, it's the very opposite. I'm like, of course. Of course. When I got to School of the Arts and I was in lighting, I thought Broadway and like local regional theaters, I thought that was the whole market for jobs.
Right.
And then they were like, what about cruise ships?
I thought so too.
Right. They're like, what about cruise ships? They're like, what about concerts? They're like, what about Cirque? What about this? And I was like, I never thought about that. And what you just did to me was, what about architectural lighting? What about lightings on the outside of fucking buildings and theme parks and things like that? And I'm like, of course, that, and we should always be looking for that shit. And that was the same problem that I had with the drama program, which is like, we're all learning the fundamental skill sets that apply to all these different things, but we're kind of only ever talking about theater and a little bit about film and television.
Right.
What about everything else? Everything else, and how happy the school should be to have you
to
as a successful
expand and explore, and exactly,
And to be able to point to you, Yuko, and say, look, here's somebody who started with a kind of raw interest in this thing called lighting. Mm-hmm. We introduced her to design. That changed her trajectory and refocused her skill set on a place where she was even more helpful. Then, mm-hmm. because of the pandemic and because of this introduction and exposure to a new industry completely within her skill set, now she is even on a visa for the job of doing this fucking really cool thing that she didn't even, you know, talk to her at 17 in Tokyo about to leave to go out into the world. And you're like, you know, you're going to design light on buildings. You'd be like, that's a fucking job? Who? Okay. You know, like that is such a cool thing. And in no Thank way you. Subpar to Broadway or whatever the fuck. Like, it's not, that's not better. This is almost better because it's like, the kids at School of the Arts need to know there's also this. There's right. also this, because there just ain't enough jobs for us all to work on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And you might find working on Broadway ain't even what the fuck you wanted it to be anyway. You might be like, who needs the pressure? Can you give me like a bank? Can you give me like, you know what I mean? Like a little income. Bit, a little bit lower stakes. And you know how many banks there are? A lot.
Yeah,
I love that. I think that's a cool story.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. I don't think I've met anybody who has spoken so highly of, or, you know, said such kind words with
I'm not blowing smoke, Yuko. I'm not just saying it to be nice. I promise. Kind. I'm not like trying to make you feel better because you bailed or something. It's not that. Yeah. It's I really sincerely think it's like,
thank you.
And I'll tell you, because I'm the same way. When I was at school, I thought, I want to direct comedy, television shows, and movies. Mm-hmm. I, instead of going to film school, chose the drama program. I started mm-hmm. in lighting because I was like, I just want a fucking job. But when I finally was like, what's the best use of my skill set? I'm like, I want to learn how to tell stories. And I want to mm-hmm. learn why human people do what they do. I want to learn and understand why audiences react to human behavior and drama the way they do. I want to mm-hmm. know what we perceive as believable. I want to know how to talk to performers in a way that gets them both excited and inspired to like perform. Like, mm-hmm. that's all interesting to me. And that I think is a theater thing more than a film and TV thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I studied the theater as a skill mm-hmm. set. With no real enthusiasm to be a professional theater maker. I love theater. Mm-hmm. I still would do it like in the summer mm-hmm. for fun or some shit, but I don't think mm-hmm. I want to work in the theater all the time. It's just not my space. But now I produce and write and direct a show that is comedy based, that is based in the world of reality television, which is something that I would have made fun of so hard 15 years ago. I would have been like, ugh, what a loser. I thought you were going to direct something cool. Because I was naive and no one told me like, dude, if you just want to write funny shit and like make it happen with people, there's a lot of ways that aren't the office mm-hmm. to do that. You know, mm-hmm. like you don't have to work with Judd Apatow to get that accomplished. There's all mm-hmm. these other things. And your story, I think, is super important for that. There's a lot of things you can do, and there's no reason why you can't fucking go to be a stage designer in 10 years if you wanted to.
Right. Yes, like, that is also true.
You're only going to work on your skill set more doing this, mm-hmm. and it's going to be in an unconventional way that when mm-hmm. you finally go to design something else, if you choose to do that, people mm-hmm. are going to be like, oh shit, where did you get this idea? You're like, I put it on a bank once. Or whatever. I keep using the bank. Yeah, that's probably not what you do, but you understand.
Yes.
Yeah, that's cool.
I do feel like I'm in a very privileged, lucky spot to be in. And I've been so, you know, like fortunate to have mentors and classmates and, you know, friends who continue to support me. And I mean, I don't have family here, so.
Right. Is that tough?
It does get tough, but like my life is here now and I continue to, and I want to like keep working hard and, you know, just do the best I can. So
to, any to thoughts sort of your family like joining you? Would they ever want to like live in the States or?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Where do you live now? Are you in New York?
No, I'm in DC.
DC.
I'm in DC. Got now. It. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
But yeah, so it's definitely not something that I like did it on my own for sure. So
I appreciate it. Well, I'll speak on your behalf since you're speaking on everyone else's. It's both. It's fully both. I appreciate your humility and your humble nature, and you're clearly a very kind person that's very grateful for everything that you've been given as far as opportunities in education. But I'll tell you the same thing that I told Sophia, which is the simply being here. By here, I mean in America, doing your art. And right now you have a job doing your art, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or at the very least, let's say you have a job that you got through your skill set.
Mm-hmm.
That's, to me, that's enough. Mm-hmm. You got into school of the arts and then you got an American job with that skill set. To me, I'm glad you got the lottery, but even if you had to apply for the other one, over here, in no one's opinion, approved. Like, what are we talking about? There are lots of people out there who are tremendously talented artists, but they haven't found a way to vehicle that to something. You know, they paint in their backyard and it's great, but they don't really know how to take that into the next world. I think the idea that you were in Japan and you got into a school that is not easy to get into in North Carolina. And not only that, you got into a narrow program. How many lighting designers did you graduate with? Five?
Yes, five. Exactly five.
Yeah.
It's really like,
well, yeah. I've been doing this for a while. This is not easy by itself. And also, this is a little thing the United States government doesn't know. And here's another thing maybe people don't know in general. DMP, quite a bit of attrition there. There's a fair amount of people who do not make it through that program. Let's talk lighting.
Yes.
There's a fair amount of people. How many people do you start with?
Well, we started with five and then we got a transfer and then one left. So,
you had an in and out.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'll give you the in and out. Did all your electricians make it through?
Well, the one that left was an electrician route.
You only had five people in the whole lighting thing to begin with?
Well, in my class, sorry, the whole program had like 30.
No, I mean in your class, you only had five people?
Oh, yeah. In my graduating class, just five of us, yes. It was a very small class, but my class was the last small, like, graduating.
They're huge
class.
After that.
Yes, it grew after, yeah.
My point is, and as things might have changed, the program is not admit, graduate automatically. A lot of programs in America are at the bachelor's level of college. Mm-hmm. You get in, unless you shoot someone, you're going to get through as long as you don't fail. You can both not fail and still not make it through the program at school because they're like, it's not quite cutting it. You're not up to snuff. It's not working out. They can just let you fucking go. So you get into a group that's five and you made it till the end and you got a job. What are we talking about? Why are you even up for debate? It shouldn't be. I'm glad you won the lottery, but you shouldn't need the lottery. You've proven on paper, documented. You did it. You can do it. Let's keep her here. Let's keep her doing the thing she's clearly dedicated to doing. I don't know why I became Bill Clinton. Let's get her here and let's make sure that, I don't know. But she is showing us through the effort, through the work, that value is there, you know? And I feel like that's something that we need to look at overall in this deeply flawed immigration system that we have, but specifically within the artistic side. I mean, I feel like I'm saying it more and more on this podcast, like every time, but like people seem to lose track of the fact that while in America, when you tell someone you're going into the arts, they fucking laugh at you. It is still art and entertainment is the number one export in America by like, really fucking far, like not even close. Film, TV, music, These are the things that the rest of the world looks to us and goes, good job. Can right. we have some more of that, please? So right. the idea that it's not valuable for you to learn how to make the most valuable thing that we make is ridiculous. Insane.
Yeah, ridiculous.
Yeah, it's bananas. And so when we have someone who has this background of being from another place and saying, uh-huh. look, I have that skill set to help you guys out with making your most important thing, I think, why are we mm-hmm. fighting with these people? Like, why are we even having to have an argument? How many violinists do we need? Fair point. But we need a bunch. Right. Like, we do need a lot of people. And lighting right. designers? Yuko, how many lighting designers are on Earth? 1,000? 2,000?
It's a small community. I know that for sure.
It's yeah. so small. I know because we've both done it, and you and I probably know half the lighting designers in America. Like, it's not a big group.
Yeah. No,
and it's also split, too, because one of the things that is drastically different, and what's wild is that there's not more crossover in this, but I almost understand why, because it's so different, is between mm-hmm. practical live lighting and film lighting. It's so different, dude.
Yes.
So different. Because
when you
design, right, for theater or for buildings mm-hmm. or for anything that's mm-hmm. going to be seen in person, mm-hmm. you have to think about all these different points of view.
Angles and perspectives.
Oh, right? No, but if you sit on this side of the house.
It's just this small rectangle box that you only need to care about.
But you have to make sure that from a 360, that shot is exactly proper. Mm-hmm. And it is so, so different. I mean, from the instruments they use to the language that mm-hmm. they use. Do you know? You know that gobo, do you know about this mm-hmm. thing? Mm-hmm. You know what it is gobos. In your world, yes. but do you know what a gobo is in the film world?
Is it different?
It has nothing to do. It has absolutely nothing to do with lighting instruments.
Huh.
And it's usually called a gobo head, but they'll say gobo for short, which is confusing as shit. For those of you who are listening who are totally lost in the weeds and bored, first of all, how did you get this far and you still care? Second of all, I'll break this down because this is one of the first things that fucked me up. So if you're uh-huh. listening to this, odds are you're probably more of a theater person. If you are and you hear gobo, I want you to close your eyes for a second in your head and think of a gobo. Whoever's listening, picture it. What is a gobo to you? All right, now I'm going to break it down. For the theater kids, they're all picturing a thin piece of metal that is literally like a sheet of metal. It's so thin, and it slides in front of a lighting element, and it changes as a template the shape and the look of the beam of light, right? So you may put mm-hmm. some leaves, you may put some fucking stars or some pattern, and you put it in front of the light. And then when you show the light on the ground, you're like, oh, wow, the light looks like stars. Okay. That's what a gobo is, right? And that's what you're thinking, I would imagine. You.
Yes. Could. Yes, exactly.
I'm on my first TV set, and we're setting up, and it's an interview setup. Uh-huh. So we're going to be doing like an interview on a green screen thing. So we got blasting with light in the front, a little bit of light from uh-huh. the back. I got the basic elements. And they go, all right, will you roll over there, get me a gobo. I was like, no problem. I go, which kind? Like, what is it? And they go, what? And I was like, well, you want a gobo? What gobo do you want? They go, anyone? No. And I was like, all right. I'm thinking, oh, well, they must all be the same. And in my head, I'm also going, I wonder what kind of gobo they're putting in an interview. Like, it doesn't seem like it would make any sense to have like fucking leaves or something. I don't get this. And so I go over to the lighting truck that is like my mm-hmm. job to drive around and know what is inside. And I have a lighting background mm-hmm. and I'm looking in this truck and I'm like, ain't no fucking gobos in here, man. Like what? Ain't nothing. I'm looking through drawers. Finally, the camera person or whoever comes around the corner is like trying to get me to set up the shot. They're like, hey, what's up, dude? Gobo? Can we get one? I'm like, I'm sorry. I'm looking. They're like, what are you looking for? Just get one out of the box. And I was like, I'm so sorry. I don't think I know what you're talking about. And he walks over to a milk crate full uh-huh. of metal knobs with little circles on it. And it is a metal fixture that goes on top of a C stand, also something we mostly don't use at all in theater, which is a metal stand that they put lights and flags and stuff like that on.
It is
the little head that you put the beam into that like telescopes out to be a thing. So you put a stand on the ground, you put a little metal head with a knob on it, and then that's your contact point for like a light or a flag, like piece of fabric or whatever. It's just a piece of metal
that's
like almost like a bracket or like a, I don't know what else the fuck you would call it. Another reason why I don't know how to talk about it, because they're like, it's a, just get us a gobo head, man. And I was like, how is it that this weird word that doesn't really exist in any other place in English that I've ever heard, I've never heard someone say gobo and it mean anything else. First time I ever heard it was in a theater and they were talking about that little piece of lighting template.
Yep.
It only exists in these two really close, but not quite connected areas. And not only that, the people in charge of it aren't aware that it means both things in like, the camera guy's looking at me like I'm an idiot. I'm looking at him like, I don't know why I'm an idiot. And, and it's crazy to me that that no one on that whole set, and I explained it to everyone else on the set that day. I was like, anybody else think, am I crazy? Not a single one of those television crew people, of which there were 10 or 12, not a single one had ever even heard of the other definition.
They'd
never even come up. They're like, oh, is that okay? Sure. Yeah, gobo head thing on top of C stand. And I was like, I get it. I get why when I was fucking 20 and I was like, I want to go to school for theater and then I want to work in film and TV. Everyone was like, be careful. They're very separate. And I was like, how can they be? That makes no sense to me. They're so similar. We point lights at this thing and they act. We point lights at this thing and they act. It's the fucking same. The only difference is it's a camera versus we're in a, there's people here. It's like, I don't get it, but they're right. It is too different. I would rather hire a theatrical lighting designer to put lights on a bank than to put lights on a film set, because I would just be worried about the full day they would spend trying to learn the goddamn words, talking to a bunch of grips. And people on the film set who are like, gobo? No. Because they also don't need gobos.
Interesting. Yeah.
There's no purpose for a gobo on a film set almost ever. You would never need to do that. Like, because it's such an impractical way to light something, because that's not how light works. It's almost never like coming through the template, unless you use it to put the lines, because it's a wooden incomplete like ceiling, moonlight
slats.
Oklahoma, how many other times is that even gonna come up?
That's so weird. That must have been so frustrating for you to
deeply
like,
frustrating,
because you know what it is in theater world.
Clothespins,
right?
That's the other big one. You know about that?
Clothespins.
Mm-hmm. You know, we use clothespins on like gels and stuff like that sometimes to clip it on the barn doors.
Yep.
Is that what you would call the clip? The wooden one?
The wooden one. I don't.
You know, like little wooden clothespin. Do you know what I'm talking about with the little metal spring in it? It's just made of wood. Two little pieces of wood.
Maybe
Are we not talking about the same thing right now? I have one of these in my house. I'm going to have to like run and get a clothespin.
What is it in film world?
They call them bullets, or even worse, and more commonly, they call them C-47s. I'm not joking.
That. I don't like that.
I hate it. There is no C-46 or 48. The C, maybe it stands for clothespin or clip. I'm not even convinced. I will tell you this. The film world, and I don't know where, I would love to do a little research on the history of this actually and see how it works. Mm-hmm. The film world plays so fast and loose with terms. I literally feel like people at some point in the history of filmmaking, probably like in LA in like the 50s or something. I don't know. I'm making this up. But at some point, a bunch of people got in the film business that did not have a background in like theater or anything else. And maybe they came from radio. I don't know. But they came over and they just started renaming things that already had fucking names. Like they were like, throw me a stinger. And you're like, extension cord? You know, the like, yes. we would call it like an extension cord. Or in theater, we might refer to it by the kind of plug it has and be like, Kimmy, get the 50-foot Edison cable.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we wouldn't, a stinger. What is a stinger? What does that have to do with anything? Why did you make up a new word? We already have a word for this. Mm-hmm. But they did that. They're like, these are C-47s. Like, we've been pinning clothes up with them for a long time. We could just call it that. They're like, nah, that's the new film word.
Oh, my goodness.
It's wild and unnecessary.
Very unnecessary. And it is, so
and
confusing.
Then it's confusing. And then when people are like, you can just hop over the fence, I'm going to be like, it's not so easy. And I'm kind of smart. I like plugging things in and I still can't figure out what the fuck a gobo is. So I don't know.
Yeah.
Who knows? Yuko, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. This was really fun.
Oh my goodness, yes. Thank you for the opportunity. This was really fun.
I feel like this podcast just keeps getting more broad. I'm going to be honest with you. I've talked to a lot of white drama students and I'm tired of it. Okay, I'm worn out. It's the same fucking story. Like, oh, I grew up in the church and now I need attention. And I'm out. Ooh. I'm out of the that. First of all, fucking 0% of them are listening this deep into the episode. There's no way they're going to hear me say that. Second of all, if they do, you know, I love you. Who am I to complain about white drama students? Hello. It's me all day. But thank you for your story. I really do appreciate it. I think the international artist story is super important. I'll give another shout out to Sophia. Everyone go back and listen to her wonderful episode. And thank her for all of these great international stories that we've been able to add to our archives here, because it can be, and maybe we'll have you back on another point when we have a little more time. We can kind of get into this too. I'd like to maybe even do a round table with several different people where we kind of talk about experiences.
That would be so much fun. Yes.
It might be good. And I can sort of moderate. We'll see. But I would love to do that with an international group, because I feel like these stories are all over the place and there's only so many. And it's kind of an insular group. A lot of times the international students can kind of clump together with other international kids because they have that experience. So they kind of end up a little bit more connected, especially in the bigger schools like music, DMP and film, where there's a lot more students. So you kind of get, it's a little harder to do that in drama when there's only like 25 kids in the whole class. But like, even so, it can kind of get broken off that way. And so I really want to make sure that we stress that, you know, the international experience is a huge part of School of the Arts. A lot of kids from all over the world who fly away from their hometowns and their home languages and their families to North Carolina to learn how to do a God knows what, and then take it into all sorts of really fun directions. Also, you talk to most people who go to School of the Arts, they're going to be like, and then I went to LA, and then I went to New York, and then I went, blah, blah. With these conversations, then I had to go back to Tokyo, then I had to go back to Delhi, then I had to go back to, you know, Rio de Janeiro, or I had whatever. And, or now I'm in DC, or now I'm in New York, or now I'm blah, blah, blah. Or I went and I came back. The stories are more, broad, or more abroad, I should say. And they, are a little more colorful, I think, in the way that they help us dive into decision-making, which I think is a big part of the show as well. It's like, why do you end up doing what you're doing? And I think your story is great for that, ending up in that place. Do you think, and this will maybe we'll put a button on it with this last question. Do you think architectural lighting is something that you find is a new career for you and interest, or is it more something that you think you want to spend some time doing now, work on the skill set, make a few checks and get a new kind of color to your resume, then go back to something more performative? Or what do you see trajectory for yourself? Not making your mind up today, but.
No, I don't know yet, but for now I'm still sort of like learning a lot about architectural lighting and still sort of exposing myself to that
humble
world.
As always.
But no, I think there's a little bit more of a mundane side to some kind of architectural lighting design, where it's a lot more about code and numbers and all that.
Right.
But there is the beauty side of things that I think with my theater background really helps bring that forward. And I really enjoy that. And then also because, you know, because it's architectural lighting, it's like forever unless the building
I was going to say arguably a bigger audience.
Right, exactly. So there is that sort of like joy and fulfillment to that. And yeah, I mean, I love it. I'm going to continue exploring and I'm going to continue challenging myself and see where we go from there, I guess.
I love that. That's so cool. And again, I can't stress it enough. I think it's so interesting that you found this this other avenue within it. And I'm excited to see where it goes.
Thank you.
Let me know. I tell you what, if you can, let me know if some project that you're working on in the DC area is something you end up being really proud of. Send it over. Let's check it out.
Thank you. We'll do. Yeah.
We'll share it.
It takes
with everybody.
A while. I will tell you that. Not theater. It's not loading in
the
fucking
building. It's a whole building. We'll give you a minute.
Yeah.
Take your time.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Yuko.
Thank you so much.